But for this round, we're going to start off today's program talking about hypothermia. Not the kind we usually discuss, which is where we cool the patients to protect their brains after cardiac arrest, but the kind of hypothermia that people do all on their own, accidental hypothermia. And instead of keeping them cold so they can leave the hospital neurologically intact, we warm them up so they don't die. I work in the Rocky Mountains, and as you can imagine, we get the occasional hypothermic patient, especially in the wintertime, but you don't have to work in a cold climate to treat accidental hypothermia. In a moment, we're going to hear Mel's interview with Dr. Doug Brown. Dr. Brown is lead author of the 2012 New England Journal of Medicine Current Concepts Review article, Accidental Hypothermia. So treating accidental hypothermia can be broken down into two pathways, patients with vital signs, and patients without vital signs.
Without vital signs.
In the first part of this talk, we're going to go over the hypothermic patient without vital signs, no pulse. Who's cold and potentially salvageable, and who's cold and dead?
Dead.
And later in the program, we'll talk about managing the hypothermic patient who has a pulse, who has vital signs. So let's get to it. Accidental hypothermia with Mel Herbert and Doug Brown.
Part one, without vital signs.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we are here with Doug Brown, who's from the Canadian. In the cold places in Vancouver. Now, Doug, tell us who you are and what the hell are we talking to you about?
I just recently graduated from the UBC FRCP Emerge program. I'm a new attending at a tertiary care teaching center and a community hospital here in Vancouver. I've been volunteering with search and rescue since about 1997. I'm a ski doc with Whistler Blackcomb and Mike Wigley's helicopter skiing. I also work with a local Canadian Society for Mountain Medicine and the International Commission for Alpine Rescue based out of Switzerland. We're going to be talking today about accidental hypothermia because myself, together with three fantastic co-authors, recently published a review paper in the New England Journal.
You, as a resident, have a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine. Most people go an entire career trying to get a paper in the frickin' New England Journal and don't get it. So how did you do that?
As a first-year resident, I joined the Doc on the Hill program at Whistler Blackcomb, and I met a really fantastic ALS paramedic named Bruce Brink, who is a former helicopter pilot and a rescue guy, and he showed me pictures from one of these international conferences that he goes to every year, and so he told me I should come, and the best part was next year it was going to be in Switzerland. So my wife and I both asked our program directors to get a month leave of absence to go to this conference and pursue our lifelong dream of going alpine climbing in the Alps. And our program directors went for it. So we went to this conference and it turned out to be amazing. All of the people were these super accomplished mountaineer rescue doctors from all over the world. And they were really into publishing papers about trying to make things better for mountain rescue. And they totally took me in like family right away and became my mentors. So while at this conference, I heard the most amazing case presentation, and it just totally hooked me on accidental hypothermia. Do you mind if I give you the case? It's fantastic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is an amazing case. Everybody strap back, sit down, let's go.
Okay, so this is the case of a 29-year-old woman who happened to be an orthopedic surgery resident at the time, and she's skiing in Norway with her buddies, and she has a tumbling fall and falls into this frozen creek. And she somehow gets trapped under the ice, upside down, kind of dangling from her feet, and there's water flowing all around her, but she's got an air pocket, so her face is up against the ice and she's breathing air. And her friends can't chip her out, and so they just watch her. And they call for help. And after 40 minutes, she becomes unconscious. After 80 minutes, the rescue team has arrived and they chip her out of the ice and she's lifeless and she's asystolic and they start CPR and winch her into a helicopter. And then they fly her 1 hour south to the tertiary care hospital. When she arrives in hospital, it's been 130 minutes of downtime, 90 minutes of CPR. Her numbers when she comes in, she got a potassium of 4.3, her pH is 6.6. They keep her on CPR and they take her upstairs and they put her on AV bypass. They measure the lowest recorded core temperature ever at 13.7 degrees Celsius. 10 minutes after putting her onto cardiopulmonary bypass, she goes into VFib. At 15 minutes, she's in a pulsatile rhythm. And after 180 minutes, they've rewarmed her and she's essentially alive again. A few hours later, she went into fluid pulmonary edema. She ended up on ECMO for 5 days. And then had a month in the ICU with all the usual renal failure, ischemic colitis, polyneuropathy. But the amazing thing about this case is that it actually made her smarter. She returned to work as a radiology resident about 6 months later, and she's now a radiologist. And she came to this conference and presented her own case. And it was just the most powerful moment you could ever imagine.
That is the best part of that story. So her friends are watching her slowly die. She's been down and is colder than anybody in recorded history, but she leaves orthopedic residency. She got smarter.
And so after this conference, I returned home as an R2 resident and was really excited about the things that I'd seen there and started trying to implement and saying, you know, we should be having some sort of procedure to get the right patients into the coronary care center and onto cardiopulmonary bypass or ECMO. And there was a lot of uncertainty and a lot of resistance that I received from the different people in my hospital. And so I started researching and I started trying to put something together. One thing led to another, and I assembled this dream team from the people that I met at ICAR in Switzerland. And so we had kind of the best in the world from Austria, Italy, and Banff. And eventually it just blossomed into a New England paper. So it was just a combination of good luck, good timing, and a whole bunch of hard work.
Now you are officially a world expert, and you're going to tell us of an approach to hypothermia. Now, a lot of people say, well, this is just an issue in Minnesota and in Canada, but some of the places that have an extraordinary amount of hypothermia are places like LA, because we have lots of homeless, and in the middle of the night, in the middle of winter, they don't have the resources to go inside, and they're not smart like Canadian homeless, I guess. And we see a lot of accidental hypothermia here, even in LA, when it's 170,000 degrees in the summer and very cold in the winter.
I like to really try and simplify things as much as I can. In the paper, we break it down into two main flavors, and one is people who have vital signs and the others who don't. And so let's just focus for a sec on the people who have no vital signs. And essentially, it's a three-step process. Is CPR required? Do I need to transfer them to an ECMO center? And then I just need to provide supportive care until I can get them there if I decide that's what's needed. The first question is CPR required? And so you just have to essentially decide, do they have obvious signs of irreversible death that you're not going to do anything about? So are clearly decapitated, they clearly had death before cooling. And that's really the most important thing for eMERGE docs to think about when they're trying to sort through these, what are often difficult cases with limited information, is you just have to decide for yourself, is there a chance that this person cooled to a significant degree? Officially, it's less than 32, but realistically, it's less than about 28. If they really got cold before their heart stopped, then they've got a chance, and you really should roll out the red carpet and advocate for transferring these people to an ECMO or a CPB center. And they can survive spectacular durations of CPR and still have a good outcome. It was one of the key findings in this paper is that the duration of CPR is not a predictor for whether the person is going to do well or not. And so when you look at these large case series of accidental hypothermia victims, the people who have 4 hours of CPR versus the people who have 1 hour of CPR before going on to ECMO CPB, that duration of CPR isn't a predictor of outcome. Essentially, the hypothermia is very protective, and if you have the right story, even if you're facing a long transport, you should advocate for transferring these patients.
So let me ask you a couple of questions about that. So we're walking through the forest, and it's all very cold, and there's snow everywhere, and we come along this person who's on the side of the road, and if they've got no head, yeah, I get it. They're dead. If they're being eaten in half by a bear, I get it. But what are the other things? You talked about, are they dead but floppy versus dead and stiff?
It's actually really difficult to use stiffness. And so one of the key messages when I talk about this subject is teaching people who is cold and dead. There's really five things you can use to decide somebody's cold and dead. The first is a clear history of cardiac arrest prior to cooling. So the person was there, they tell you this person died, and then they got cold. You're done. That person's dead. If you measure a core temperature greater than 32 degrees Celsius and they're in asystole, hypothermia is not the cause. If they're completely frozen solid, so they're frozen solid, the chest is not compressible, they're an ice cube, they're dead. Everybody wants to try and use laboratory values. I think a potassium greater than 12 is a very safe cutoff if you don't have a good history to go on. It used to be 8, and then it was 10, and then there's recently been a case report of a potassium of 11.9 that was successfully resuscitated. So those are essentially your five things. History, a core temp that's not cold enough, the patient's frozen solid, a potassium greater than 12, and then there's three special circumstances to learn about. Trauma, drowning, and avalanche burial. Trauma is something that most eMERGE docs are extremely familiar with, and everybody knows that blunt traumatic arrest has less than 1% survival. The fact is, if you have a major trauma with hypothermia, you're going to decrease your survival even more. So if your history states that this patient arrested from traumatic causes, even if they were 30 degrees when it happened, they're not going to be salvageable. Trauma and hypothermia are a deadly, deadly combination. When it comes to drowning, history is the most important thing. And the way I divide it is I divide it into submersion versus immersion. Submersion is when a patient goes under the water immediately, they have a hypoxic cardiac arrest, and then they cool off. Those people have a dismal prognosis. Immersion, which is rare, is the one case where you might consider prolonged resuscitation. And an immersion injury is where somebody is in the water, but their head is still above water and they're still breathing, and they manage to cool to the point where they're protected by the hypothermia before they slide under the water and have their arrest. And that prognosis can be good. It's the same as the prognosis for exposure, accidental hypothermia. The one caveat with submersion injuries is the pediatric outlier. And there's a classic case of a 2.5-year-old who fell into a 5-degree creek, immediately went underwater, and was pinned underwater for 66 minutes. He cooled extremely rapidly, and so simultaneously cooled and had a hypoxic cardiac arrest. This kid was found with a core temperature of 19 degrees in asystole. He had 2 hours of CPR, went on to ECMO, and had a full recovery. It's all about history. If you had extremely rapid cooling simultaneous with the cardiac arrest, there may be a chance in the pediatric population. But in general, drowning has a dismal prognosis, and if you start advocating for your drowning patients to go on to ECMO and cardiopulmonary bypass, then you're going to wear out the resource with cases that don't do well, and you're not going to be able to access that resource when you've got the right case.
So our radiologist was the perfect example. And so she was immersed, she's getting colder and colder and colder, she's breathing, and then she finally arrests at the point where her heart says, "This is too freaking cold to be alive, I'll die now." So that's very different than she falls into the water and gets submerged and she has an arrest and she's getting brain damage as she's cooling. So they're the two different scenarios.
Exactly. So was the person intact when their heart stopped because of a hypothermia? Or did this person's heart stop for some other reason and then they cooled? The avalanche situation is also a little bit tricky. It's a bit specialized since most people aren't going to see that. But with avalanches, essentially people die of three things. They either have terrible trauma during the avalanche and die right away, or they have their airway packed with snow and they can't breathe and they have a hypoxic arrest, or they have an air pocket and they can breathe for a while and then they get cold and have a cardiac arrest. The rule of thumb with them is if they haven't been buried long enough to get cold enough, you know that hypothermia wasn't the cause of cardiac arrest. And the magic number is 35 minutes. So the world record for speed of cooling in an avalanche is 10 degrees Celsius per hour. So it takes 35 minutes to get cold enough for hypothermia to essentially protect you or to be the cause of your cardiac arrest. If they've been buried less than 35 minutes and they come out dead, they're dead from either trauma or asphyxia. If they come out greater than 35 minutes and they have an airway, their mouth is not packed with snow, and you don't think they died from massive trauma immediately, that's the patient that you would consider prolonged resuscitation and advocating for transport to a coronary care center.
Let's take a break here and review, because that was a lot of information. So what defines hypothermia? It's a core temp of less than 35 Celsius. The bad things happen at a much lower temperature than that, but less than 35 Celsius, your patient's hypothermic. Step two, the big decision point. Does your patient have vital signs? We're going to start out with no. No vital signs. In the emergency department, CPR is probably already in progress, but let's say that it's not, and you need to decide whether you're going to start CPR. Maybe you're a first responder or a paramedic, or you're operating in the pre-hospital setting. Your hypothermic patient has no vital signs. When should you stop there and call it? You're done. You should stop and not proceed if there are signs of irreversible death. In other words, were they dead before they got cold, or did the cold make their heart stop? On paper, that sounds pretty logical, but the answer isn't going to always be so obvious. So how do you decide if they're cold and dead or cold and salvageable? Number one, is there a clear history of cardiac arrest prior to cooling? Number two, if they're in asystole and their core temp is over 32 Celsius, hypothermia is probably not the cause. If they're frozen solid, they're dead. Not frozen solid where you say, "Man, I'm so cold, I'm frozen solid." but they're actually solid. Number 4, a potassium over 12. They're probably dead, but you know, that number keeps climbing. When I was in training, we saw a lot of hypothermic patients. Say we use 8 to 9, but the number goes up over time as someone with a higher potassium survives. And then there's some special circumstances, trauma, drowning, and avalanche burial. If the patient had a trauma arrest and then became hypothermic, or was hypothermic and then had a trauma arrest, probably not salvageable. With drowning, there's submersion and immersion. With submersion, they drown, have a hypoxic arrest, and then cool off. They're dead. With immersion, they start off in the water, but they're still breathing. Imagine treading water in an icy lake, or the orthopedic surgery resident they heard about in the beginning. The body cools down to the point where the hypothermia may be protective before their head goes underwater and they arrest. Those patients, hypothermic with a history of immersion drowning, may make it with prolonged CPR and rewarming. How do you tell the difference with the patient in front of you? You need to know the history, and it's hard to tell by just looking at them. And a few caveats to all this. The duration of CPR is not a predictor of outcome. And with avalanche, after someone's trapped under the snow from an avalanche, it takes 35 minutes to cool down to the point where hypothermia will cause the cardiac arrest. If you pull them out before that time and they're dead, likely it was not the hypothermia that did it. It was the trauma or asphyxia. Let's get back to it.
James Cameron has that great movie, The Abyss, and everybody should go watch it.
And they are in the bottom of the ocean. And they're in their little submarine. And the submarine breaks. And it's freezing cold and under pressure, and it's just bad. But they've only got one pressurized suit, and they can't get back to the main capsule, the way everybody else is. There's only one suit. Only one of them can get there. So what do? After a little bit of back and forth, this strange couple works out that what they should do is that they should have Ed put on the pressurized suit.
I drown and you tow me back to the rig.
No. No!
Yes, this water!
No!
Only a couple of degrees above freezing. I go into deep hypothermia. My blood will go like ice water.
She's going to go into cardiac arrest, and then they are going to defibrillate her and give her epi and get her back. It's a hypothermia episode in The Abyss by James Cameron, and it's pretty accurate. It's pretty good because she gets cold first, and then she arrests, and then...
So what you're telling me is that it wouldn't work because they couldn't cool her fast enough. Don't worry, you still need to see the movie.
What I would do is I would cool her first, so I'd cool her down to 26 degrees and then jostle her about so that she went into a malignant arrhythmia and now she's dead, and then I'd zip her over to the other side and resuscitate her. Let's talk about your unconscious hypothermic patient that has vital signs, because that's going to be more common.
Vital signs.
When should you not worry about this patient, and when should you consider moving that patient to an ECMO CPB center because they're probably going to arrest? And there's a few things the clinician can use. Things that are not worrisome with your unconscious patient are bradycardia, a bit of mild hypotension, and atrial fibrillation. Those are normal and to be expected with accidental hypothermia. If, however, you're seeing cardiac instability, ventricular arrhythmias, hypotension out of proportion to the degree of cooling, which is a little difficult to sort out sometimes, or very low core temperatures, so below 28 and especially below 24. Those patients, if you look at them the wrong way, they're going to go into cardiac arrest. And hypothermic patients that go into cardiac arrest, if you treat them in an ECMO center, their survival is about 50%. If you treat them in a non-ECMO center, their survival is about 10%. If you have a patient with cardiac instability from hypothermia, you want to package them up from your shop and move them to a different shop that has ECMO CPB. Because if and when they arrest, they're going to do much better if they're in a CPB center.
Let's talk about the unconscious hypothermic patient who has vital signs for a moment. We'll get more into this later in the conversation, but this is the other side of decision tree. What we've been going over is the patient with no vital signs, no pulse, and trying to sort out whether or not to resuscitate. Now, a patient who has vital signs, and it's not a matter of if we're going to resuscitate them, but how. What did you not worry about? Bradycardia, mild hypotension, and atrial fibrillation. You should expect to see those things in the setting of hypothermia. But what should you worry about? Ventricular arrhythmias, severe hypotension, and a temperature below 28, especially a temperature below 24. And treating a patient at an ECMO cardiac bypass center, an ECMO CPB center, really seems to make a difference here. Doug said 50% survival in the ECMO CPB center and 10% in the non-ECMO center. And that theme is going to come up again and again, and it's a major branch point in your decision tree. Hypothermic patients who are unstable do better at an ECMO CPB center. Unstable, of course, being a relative term, since hypothermic patients get a gimme with bradycardia, mild hypotension, and AFib, but not ventricular arrhythmias, severe hypotension, and a temp below 28, especially a temp below 24. Now say you're walking in the woods. You've just finish your picnic, it's a lovely day, a cool, brisk fall day, and you come across someone lying on the ground. They're cold. They have no pulse. What should you do?
We're back in the forest. We're walking along. Here's the dead person. I think that they're still a live dead person, or a potentially come back to life dead person. I get on the cell phone, and I'm calling the paramedics, and they're an hour away. I have the potential to put them in the back of my car and get them to the local ER in 5 minutes, so a few questions. Do I start CPR immediately that I find this person? Do I keep them cool when I throw them in the back of the car if I'm transporting them? Do I throw ice on them? Or should I start to rewarm them immediately?
If the person is clearly dead, so no signs of life, no heartbeat, no blood pressure, you want to start CPR right away. This used to be controversial because people were always worried about having somebody with essentially an undetectable, very slow heartbeat and putting them into asystole by starting CPR. But the fact of the matter is the perfusion that you're going to give them with good CPR is infinitely better than whatever terrible perfusion they had prior to you starting CPR that you couldn't even detect it. So the answer to your first question is if they appear dead and you think they cooled before they died, start CPR right away. The answer to your second question, should I cool them? Should I warm them? Should I do nothing? The literature doesn't give us any good answers. Practically what we've recommended in the paper is that in the field, you should attempt minimally invasive rewarming. So you should insulate them, you should apply hot water bottles or a bear hugger if you have it. You're not actually going to succeed in rewarming them. All you're going to do is prevent further heat loss. And by preventing further heat loss, you're going to decrease the potential morbidity for this patient down the road. It's a soft recommendation, but what we recommend is minimally invasive rewarming right from the get-go. So you start CPR, you do minimally invasive rewarming. If you need to manage their airway, you manage their airway. If you need to give them fluid, you give them warm fluid, so you give them 38 degrees saline. You essentially do what you need to do, but handle them cautiously. In your department, focus on high quality CPR, advocate for transport to an ECMO CPB center, and as long as you are within 6 hours of a good center and you've got a good history, even in your, if you and your shop were to get return of spontaneous circulation, there's a very good chance this person's going to go on to fluid pulmonary edema and they're going to require those services anyways. You should prevent further heat loss, bear hugger in the department, warm IV fluids if you're going to give any fluids. A trial of electricity and epinephrine is reasonable, but if it's not working, don't persist. So one or two doses and then wait until the patient's warmed 5 or 10 degrees of core temperature and then try again. Everybody really wants to talk about chest tube lavage, peritoneal lavage, bladder lavage. And I essentially think that there's no role for it unless you can't transport your patient to your ECMO CBP center. So if for some reason you can't transport or it's longer than 6 hours, then I would suggest the thoracic lavage, peritoneal lavage, bladder lavage route. But if you're going to be transporting that patient, I would just continue my high quality CPR and let them rewarm when they come back on the ECMO circuit.
We've had a case where we did thoracotomy and direct heating of the heart that way, and very controversial, and lots of people got in trouble for it. Is there any literature on that?
I haven't seen any literature of case reports of the thoracotomy. There is a significant amount of literature around the chest tube lavage, and some people do the one tube method and some people do the two tube method. Unfortunately, there's no good case series the way there is with ECMO CPB, and so you're really just sewing together case reports. When I reviewed the literature, the chest tube lavage is essentially your second best. It's a distant second best. And so we really in the paper advocate for transport to ECMO CPB. And if for some reason you can't transport to ECMO CPB, then use the thoracic lavage.
We took a little detour there as to what to do with the guy found down hypothermic in the woods, for example, but under a bridge could just as easily fit there. Keep them warm, and once you get to the ED, continue CPR. And do you have a Lucas device, the LUCAS device, or something similar in your department that's a contraption that can do chest compressions endlessly without pause? To me, this seems like the perfect use for one of these things. It's pretty likely that your hypothermic patient without vital signs is going to need CPR for a long time. And if you're doing CPR or you're
your Lucas device is doing CPR, and you're going for the save, get the patient to an ECMO center. 10 versus 50% survival sounds worth it. Even if you get RASC, return of spontaneous circulation, even if their heart starts beating again, still get them to an ECMO bypass center. If you can't get them to an ECMO CPP center within 6 hours, then do your invasive rewarming. Warm water chest tube lavage, peritoneal lavage, bladder lavage. We're going to take a break there and get back to hypothermia after this next piece. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what to do as far as ACLS drugs, and then more on what to do with the patient who has vital signs. How should you rewarm them? Because that's going to be the vast majority of the ones that we see.